Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
It is my great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Nathan Fayard, an assistant professor of English at Indiana Wesleyan University. He specialises in Old English literature, medievalism and the Inklings, and he's recently authored a new book called The Recovered Images. We're going to be talking about Nathan's work, as well as sharing a paper that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University in Oregon. And the title of Nathan's paper there was Prometheus on Perelandra, the Inversion of the Satanic Hero. Nathan, we are about to hear your paper. Is there anything else that it would be helpful for us to have read before we listen to your talk? Is it helpful for us to have read Perelandra, Milton, Shelley, Byron, the whole back catalogue of all these poets?
So the most important pieces, especially for the paper, because this paper is sort of a piece of the larger paper that was published in the Journal of Inkling Studies, what's most important is Perelandra and Prometheus Unbound. If you've read some Byron, that can help you get more context for the romantic hero and the Byronic hero. But that figure is not all that strange to us. It's not all that alien to us. We literally just in the last couple of years had a successful television series in which Lucifer is the main character. And, you know, he's very much that kind of character. We love that because it is the celebration of self. And we all want that. We all want to be in charge. And so that will probably not be all that disconcerting.
What you are about to hear is Nathan's paper from the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Nathan's paper was Prometheus on Perelandra, the Inversion of the Satanic Hero.
Howdy. So this is a little piece of a larger argument, a larger article that was published recently in the Journal of Inkling Studies. So there's a lot more here than I have time to touch on in 18 minutes, but I'll give you a piece of it for the time we have. So C.S. Lewis's Perelandra, the second novel in his cosmic trilogy, is often read as a reimagining of elements of one of his favorite works, Paradise Lost. But this obvious source for Lewis's Edenic novel looms so large in criticism that it tends to overshadow other possible reimaginings of other sources that may have gone unnoticed. In addition to reworking the fall narrative of Paradise Lost, there's evidence that Lewis also tried to reimagine another one of his favorite subjects, Romanticism. These romantic echoes become particularly noticeable when Perelandra is compared to Lewis's favorite long poem of the Romantic period, Percy Shelley's Prometheus Unbound. Lewis's reimagining, or you might say transfiguring, of his romantic source has two levels. The first is the reworking of the romantic hero, especially his more satanic form, by splitting the archetypal qualities of such characters between his villain and his hero, leaving the possessed Weston with those attributes that he thought destructive and endowing Ransom with those that he thought were positive. And the second level is found in the purification of the apocalyptic vision that ends Prometheus Unbound, which Lewis rewrites in the dream vision at the finale of Perelandra. In doing so, he critiques the progressive humanistic philosophy of Shelley's poem in the same way he critiqued the romantic misreading of Milton's Satan through his monstrous Unman. There's cross-pollination between the two threads, however, as the ideas behind Shelley's Tale of Prometheus provide the roots for Lewis's villain's own philosophy. And the two are closer than you might suspect at first glance. Unfortunately, today I only have time to talk about the first piece of this puzzle, Lewis's treatment of the romantic or satanic hero. The author originally tackled the sympathetic reading of Milton's Satan that gave birth to this archetype in his preface to Paradise Lost, where he argued that the admiration for the angelic rebel as a heroic figure, exemplified by Blake, Shelley, Byron, and their romantic counterparts, was misplaced at best and perhaps dangerous at worst. This passing reference reveals Lewis's discomfort with the concept of the romantic hero that grew out of this tradition of misreading Milton's Satan. And it's no wonder that he would object to the satanic hero and the ideology behind him, because the character represented just that strain within the romantic authors that the author described as troubling in his Pilgrim's Regress in its preface. These are qualities that Peter Thorslev, in the definitive work on the romantic hero archetype, described as the glorification of self and rebellious individualism. The defining characteristic of these characters is pride, which Lewis, in line with tradition, classified as the root of all sin. In Mere Christianity, drawing on Augustine, he declared that the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. And unsurprisingly, in that passage, he connects the vice with its patron devil, Satan, adding that it was through pride that the devil became the devil. And pride is the complete anti-God state of mind. This was a position that he developed in greater length in his preface, where he wrote that pride resulted when a conscious creature becomes more interested in self than in God, and wishes to exist on its own, specifying that the first creature who ever committed it was Satan, the proud angel who turned from God to himself, not wishing to be a subject, but to rejoice like a tyrant in having subjects under him. It is from this perspective that Lewis critiqued the romantic's love of Milton's Satan. And it is through this lens that he viewed the romantic hero, for whom, as Thorslev puts it, hubris becomes a cardinal virtue rather than a cardinal sin. Nonetheless, there's undoubtedly something attractive in the figure of Milton Satan and the archetype he comes to represent. And it's precisely this alluring quality that gave Lewis pause. He argued that the idea that any being like Satan, if there were a real one, or a real human being, insofar as he resembles Milton Satan, is or ought to be an object of admiration either consciously or subconsciously on the part of the poet or the audience or both, was wholly erroneous. Thus, in his reimagining of these romantic archetypes, he attempts to create what he thinks of as a realistic type to which the romantics unwittingly turn their attention. He tries to create not just a realistic Satan, who bears almost no resemblance to his predecessor, but also a realistic satanic hero. And it's no accident that this hero is, in fact, one of our villains. In the case of his space trilogy villains, Lewis is approaching them in the same way that Milton had, he argued, approached his own, as ultimately comedic figures. In his preface, Lewis denigrates the austerity and grandeur of Satan's character, which had been so admired by the romantics, arguing that this greatness is hollow, false, and ultimately revealed as absurd. As a result, as he puts it, at the precise point where Satan meets something real, laughter must arise, just as steam must arise when fire meets water. Lewis also writes that we know Milton believed everything detestable to be in the long term ridiculous, and Mere Christianity commits every Christian to the belief that the devil is, in the long run, an ass. In much the same way, his devilish characters are, in the final analysis, equally foolish. No wonder, then, that Lewis called Weston Devine his buffoon villains. These characters are, in the end, parodic, but they're still recognizable as parodies of romantic heroes, specifically, or at least Weston is. One needs but compare Professor Weston, the chief antagonist of the first two books, to the most prominent of such heroes to note the similarities. As Thorslev describes, these characters are Solitaries by birth, by nature, by breeding, because of the acuteness of their minds and sensibilities, but most of them are solitaries also because of conscious moral choice. Weston, despite being accompanied by his partner, Divine, clearly considers himself a man alone. And that solitude stems from his rejection of all inherited truth as mere trash and his willful pursuit of his quest. Lewis emphasizes the physicist's aloofness and his lack of engagement with other characters, even his own partner in peril. For example, during his first interplanetary journey, we learn that during his watches off, he was almost entirely silent, no matter who his company was. This sense of personal isolation only grows over the course of the series, and by the time he arrives at Perelandra, what has been implicit in his character becomes explicit as he declares to Ransom, "I've become conscious that I'm a man set apart." Just like his romantic predecessors, the professor is solitary by nature and by conscious choice, driven to it by his sense of purpose and his rejection of the constraints of tradition and morality. He's also completely inflexible in his beliefs and his purpose, just like his romantic predecessors, for whom, as Thorslev says, adjustment to society as it exists is impossible. They either go down to glorious defeat, cursing God and dying, or they commit their lives to transforming the world. Weston possesses just these qualities. He certainly tries to transform the world, or in fact, many worlds. And if he had his druthers, he would go down gloriously. He's clearly, as we see at the end of Out of the Sun and Planet, ready to sacrifice himself in the great work that he believes he's engaged in. But Lewis's program of reinscription casts his final defeat as piteous instead of glorious.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from NT Wright. Ask NT Wright Anything, the Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now let's get back to today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
Like Byron's Manfred, Weston is an outcast among men, with no concern for the structures and philosophies that govern his lesser contemporaries, for whom he has nothing but contempt. Like Cain, he's driven by desire for knowledge, and he will accept only empirical truth, although it does him no good. Like Shelley's Prometheus, with whom he has the most in common in some ways, he has dedicated his existence to a cause much larger than himself, ultimately identifying his rebellion with the fate of humanity as a whole. It's worth noting that Lewis was particularly fond of Shelley, even defending him against T.S. Eliot's attacks. Lewis especially loved Shelley's grandest treatment of a satanic hero, his Prometheus Unbound, the poet's exploration of the Greek myth, where Prometheus stole fire from the gods for humanity and was eternally imprisoned for his transgressions. Shelley's poem tells the tale of Prometheus's release and the apocalyptic reordering of the world that follows, as reality is freed from the tyrannical authority of Jupiter, the king of the gods. Lewis was entranced by Shelley's poem, and even went so far as to declare it the greatest long poem in the 19th century and the only long poem of the highest kind in that century that approached to perfection. High praise. This being the case, perhaps it's unsurprising that there are so many echoes of Shelley's work to be found in the Cosmic Trilogy, especially Perelandra. In fact, Weston's great cause bears striking similarities to that of the Titan hero Prometheus. While Weston in the first novel declares in his broken old solar, "Me care for man, care for our race," by the second he has found a much grander and more Shelleyan philosophy. He has come to believe in a progressivist view of reality and a grand fate for humankind along with the universe as a whole, with himself, of course, as its agent. Prometheus, for his part, achieves the metaphysical status that Weston only claims to have and is motivated by a very similar conception of the inevitable grand fate of mankind and a unified view of reality. The story of Prometheus, with its pantheistic overtones, involves an elevation of humankind in general at the expense of the individual human. And the triumph of Prometheus is the triumph of mankind in general. In the same way, Weston, as Sanford Schwartz observes, is impelled by a seemingly impersonal ideal of human progress. And like Prometheus, he believes he embodies that sense of progress, of the inevitable transcendence of humanity. Weston's vision of this destiny is certainly less poetic than Shelley's and certainly less romantic. But nevertheless, it comes from similar origins and has similar consequences. It's what we might imagine as the realistic implementation of such a philosophy as Prometheus espouses. Obviously, Shelley, who was famously sympathetic to native populations and oppressed peoples, would have never approved of Weston's methods, but the ends of the spacefaring traveler and his followers pursue a very similar logic. They attempt to perfect man on his own terms, free from the constraints of gods and society and tradition. Just as Prometheus can only be free once Jupiter, who is the figure of the false man-made gods of humanity in Shelley's poem, is deposed. This misguided desire for freedom of action drives both Weston and those who follow him. The last novel of the series tells the story of Weston's successors, the scientists of the Nice, who try a Frankenstein-esque experiment in order to create the Superman, God Almighty, a being made by man who transcends and perfects man. In essence, this creature parodies the Shelleyan dream of human perfectibility and the escape from theistic rule, providing a dark reflection thereof. This creature, an artificially preserved severed head, as empty of soul as Shelley's Jupiter himself, has its hollowness filled by demonic powers, thus becoming equally as tyrannical as Shelley believed its godly predecessors were. Rather than ushering in an earthly paradise, this creature would create hell on earth. This, to Lewis, may be the ultimate fate of any program that begins by rejecting God and the hierarchical order that points to him. Such philosophies as we see in Perelandra and in That Hideous Strength are doomed by the destructive, self-focused pursuit of humans, which lead to a cold and empty environs, such as the sterile and dead world created by the race of creatures on the moon whom Weston's followers admire so much. It is in this manner that Lewis's parodic version of romantic heroes differ most distinctly from the predecessors. The man-made god will be divorced from and triumphant over nature, which is Weston's dream as well, but this is a very unromantic notion. Lewis positions his villains as romantic heroes in many ways, but he robs them of some of the key ameliorating features that make up the archetype. Though Weston and many members of the Nice possess the more negative characteristics of the romantic hero, they all lack the two qualities that ultimately win a reader's sympathy for such characters. They have no sensitivity to the natural world, and they are all completely incapable of the one virtue which, in its greatest development, allows the romantic hero a measure of redemption, the capacity for love. While Byron's Manfred may be much the same in his unyielding will as Milton's Satan, his great model, there are also characters like Prometheus and Cain, whose situations are improved by their capacity to love, and they are more predominant than the other. And this is both in terms of loving a romantic partner and, in a larger sense, a love for the race of men at large. The major project of restoration and regeneration in Prometheus Unbound is actually only enabled through the hero's ability to love. And it is through his relationship with his wife, Asia, that the final redemption of the world is possible. Of course, Weston's claim to be driven by his dedication to the human race is in the abstract, but the empty and destructive nature of his motivation is clear. The members of the Nice, for their part, are completely incapable of sincere love for each other, or for anyone else, for that matter. being driven entirely by the wholehearted pursuit of their own gain. Lewis constructed his villains this way because one of his most basic beliefs was, insofar as a man still has an appreciation for any good thing, be it nature or people, that man is not wholly lost. According to his schema and his own romantic tendencies, nature points us back to transcendent truth, as does the capacity to love someone beside yourself. Instead, Lewis transplanted these qualities, these positive qualities, onto his protagonist, in whom we find an alternative to the romantic hero archetype. Though Ransom himself lacks the austere, willful, and aristocratic grandeur of the traditional romantic hero, he does possess those characteristics that Lewis believed could lead a soul to truth. But that's a discussion for another time. In the end, the reinscription of the romantic hero as true villain is part of the process by which Lewis attempts to correct what he saw as the beautiful but misguided ideals of the romantics, especially Shelley, baking out the dross of what he saw in the goal of the poet's verse. Addressing the redemption of the world that occurs in the fourth act of Prometheus, Lewis remarked that it might be true, as the materialists hold, that there is no possible way by which men can arrive at such felicity. Or, again, as Mr. Eliot and I believe, that there is one way and only one, and that Shelley has missed it. The romantic elements in Perelandra are reinterpreted through Weston and Ransom, emptied of the corruption Lewis saw in them, and brought back in line with the truths that he championed, the one way that he believed many of their originators had missed. Again.
That was Nathan Fayard's paper, Prometheus on Perelandra, the Inversion of the Satanic Hero, which was given at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference held at George Fox University. Nathan, now that we've heard your paper, is there any other helpful clarifications you want to share or anything else you want to add?
So I think that I will say, you know, as I said, prefacing it, that's just a piece of it. So there's a lot more in the Inklings article that's trying to condense down a pretty complex idea into what you can say in 15 minutes is a bit of a challenge. So feel free to check out the larger text, which has the same title. And I think that, you know, go rediscover the romantics and discover why Lewis loved them and see how they can help us. How Lewis and the Romantics read together can help sort of enrich and deepen one another, and how they both can widen our capacity to understand our world.
Well, I'll make sure that there is a link to that Inklings article in the show notes, Nathan, so that people can read that. But where else can we go to find out some of the things that you're up to, find out about your work, find out when your book's coming out?
So I don't have much of a footprint online. I have a Facebook page, so I will talk about those things there. But I am sort of at the beginning of my career writing about Lewis, and I had an article in Christ and Pop Culture on the TV show Loki, which actually is dealing with some of the similar kinds of questions, especially the idea of self-aggrandizement and sort of the costs of that. And the title of that paper is, I think, For a More Glorious Purpose. But, I'm sure talking about these things everywhere I get the chance when I finally have the book ready. So stay tuned, and hopefully it will get out there somewhere.
Great. Well, we'll have you on again when it's ready, but thank you.
I would be delighted.
Thank you so much, Nathan. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you today.
Thank you, Ruth. It has been an absolute delight. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there at premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
O'Reilly Auto Parts puede ayudarte a revisar tu Luz Check Engine, Luz ABS o Luz de mantenimiento con O'Reilly Veriscan. El servicio es gratis y recibirás un informe con soluciones verificadas por técnicos maestros certificados ASE. Si necesitas ayuda, O'Reilly Auto Parts te puede recomendar un taller. Pregunta por O'Reilly Veriscan hoy mismo. Oh, oh.